Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Nelson Lichtenstein, director of the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy, brings an understanding of the issues and ideas, past and present, that illuminate the nature of American capitalism to shape the multiracial working class struggle. In the fighting spirit of May Day now, dare to struggle, dare to win. The first thing I did was pick up the New York Times today, and it says, we've created this class of centimillionaires and billionaires who have not been good for this country. They may build a wing on a museum, but it's not infrastructure. It's not the, and they say, middle class. I wanted to start with that because, indeed, the CEOs they're referring to most immediately, Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Robert Iger of Disney and John Stankley of AT&T and on and on. And my question is, how do you understand or analyze what's perhaps missing from working class culture such that these robber barons of new seem to have complete impunity? Indeed, have we just established a kind of worship of the golden calf? Why isn't the working class angrier and more ready to assume the path of resistance for the harms and the hurts that they have in relationship to this incredible vulgar accumulation of untold riches?
In the 1890s, when there was pitched battles between Homestead or the 1930s, you know, we have had in the last many years pitched battles of the working class versus various companies. They've lost the mobility of capital and the access of ruling class people to all sorts of social media. And there have been remarkable moments of upheaval. And if you think of Black Lives Matter as a working class protest, and last summer, certainly, it was actually very multiracial, by the way. If you think of that, if that's your definition, and I think that one could make that argument. Now, it's directed against the police, but, you know, that's a longstanding, you know, issue, and it's had some impact. One could make that argument. The more provocative and controversial would be that the enormous sensitivity, and appropriate sensitivity, we have to race and gender questions today means that class issues, we talk about the working class, where there's almost a ghost word in front of that, white. Now, it shouldn't be, but it has, you know, it's entered into our lexicon, that therefore the class becomes somewhat marginalized. And when you have a Me Too movement, which doesn't make much distinction between the harassment of a Walmart clerk by their assistant manager versus a Hollywood by some mogul, then it tends to elide the question of race. Now, I'm not sure what my own view on this really, I do think there's been a devaluation of essentially class, or class has been turned into a white thing. I mean, that's what Trump tried to do, despite the fact that actually the people who voted for him were actually higher income than those who voted for either Hillary or Biden. Nevertheless, he was able to pull that kind of rhetorical sleight of hand off.
So the objective conditions within the society, since it doesn't, you mentioned Trump, it doesn't happen automatically. Is it the media? Is it the severity of the labor laws that are skewed against the benefit and advancement of the working class? Mm-hmm. Is it the unions themselves that have developed a kind of complacent or labor bureaucracy that has been more reticent about confronting the forces of capital? Or is it that we also need new methods and ways to contemporize our organizing, labor community strategies? So
I've written about this, the labor bureaucracy. I've written tomes denouncing union leaders for being too cautious. But at this particular moment, I don't think that's the issue. I don't think that's the question. What is the problem? And I think here's one of the salutary benefits of this struggle at Bessemer, was that the issue of that particular part of the labor law that was, you know, created in the 30s, which, you know, looks to the collective bargaining between a workforce and the management of one company or one worksite, that perception That is broken. And in its place, I think that that opens the door to saying either reform it, you know, in a radical fashion. And one thing, for example, the new PRO Act, which is, I don't think, I think actually it may not pass. I'm doubtful that it will pass. It protect the right to organize. It's much more radical, that law, than anything put forward by the unions over the previous many decades. So it, at least it shows a certain ambition. But then, of course, there are other mechanisms which we have, which are now being rooted about. For example, on the one hand, it's a sectorial bargaining, that idea that you bargain for a whole industry. And one thing, I'm publishing in The Nation just in the next 2 days, a piece on the new antitrust. And one of the remarkable things is that there's a new, I mean, it's still confined to the academy and some elements of the left wing of the Democratic Party, but nevertheless, a new understanding that what antitrust is all about is not just keeping prices low for people. That's not the point of antitrust. It's breaking up corporate power. And this returns us to the progressive era, to the New Deal, when both jurists and politicians, Sherman himself, who created the Sherman Antitrust Act, he wasn't concerned about prices. You know, he was concerned about corporate power. And I think that the new antitrust, and Biden has appointed some of these young radical lawyers to the FTC in places, I think that is a new front which is going to confront capital, this enormous wealth. And I think that in fact, a growing movement, not just among the usual suspects, the usual left-wing people, the right wing. I mean, the remarkable thing today, I don't trust them, but the conservatives are hostile to Silicon Valley, so along with the left. So I'm a little more optimistic about these questions than I used to be.
You mentioned basically two things in this response, and I wanted to pick one of them, which is the sectional bargaining thing, which is very popular in Europe.
Yeah.
If you could expand upon what that would mean, first of all, what's happening in Europe? I mean, but not in length, but also how could that apply to the U.S.?
It actually began. It was actually very popular in the 100 years ago in the progressive era. It's the idea that there are large sections of people in industry. Now, 100 years ago in the U.S., it was women, you know, and children, you know, who were not citizens, therefore couldn't protect themselves, so-called, you know. But the idea that you need a kind of government-supervised kind of committees, which employers and workers would have their voice there, which would establish sort of like the minimum wage, which covers everybody, but this would be kind of minimum wages and conditions of employment for specific industries today, fast food, you know, or it could be warehouses, or it could be retail, establishments, and for the entire industry. I mean, we do in one sense. This is what we do with laws. We pass a occupational health and safety law, which applies to everybody. People who want it to apply to them and who don't. There's no election in a workplace as to whether or not you want the Occupational Safety and Health Administration to apply. It's just there. So this would be a way of fine-tuning that in a way for specific industries, giving workers various kinds of rights. It could not just wages. It could extend to shifts. It could extend to various forms of representation. You know, you have to have, you know, meetings. And I in the pandemic moment, and some other people out here in California were very active in pushing for health and safety councils would be mandated in all workplaces that met the public. And that actually got some legs on it. The Los Angeles Board of Supervisors passed an ordinance which mandated that. It hasn't been put into effect yet, but it was there. So that idea, and of course, yes, in Europe it does exist more widely. But this idea is gaining some traction. Now, it's got to be careful about it, because firms like Uber and Lyft want a phony version of this, which goes along with their efforts to declare all the people who work for them not true workers, but, you know, independent contractors. So they picked up on it as well. So you have to be careful that you aren't making that concession to capital, but that these are actual workers. And, of course, it doesn't preclude the possibility of forming a traditional union that bargains. But I think in New York, there's been efforts on the fast food, and actually passed a sectional bargaining for fast food. It's been, I think it's been stymied in the courts, but it's there.
let's take something like Amazon or a Walmart. Does that
right.
mean that in terms of organizing that we're interested in laws that would affect them presumably globally? And or is it about worker cross-border organizing to back up each other more and systematize its demands so that an injury to one is an injury to all? I'm not quite sure proceeds with sectional,
yeah. Sectional bargaining. Yeah, that's normally, you know, country by country. That would be an enormous accomplishment if all 4,500 Walmart stores in the U.S. were covered by that at the federal level rather than the state. Traditionally in America, back in the progressive era, it was done state by state. We still have some of these wage boards still exist in some states, Massachusetts and California. No, I mean it'll be country by country, and that alone would be a huge accomplishment. Now, internationally, there have been efforts through a combination of the ILO and pressure on some of the big brands, in clothing particularly, like H&M.
And that's the International Labor Organization.
Yeah, the International Labor Organization.
Mm-hmm.
To regulate and create standards in these supply chains. And so almost a decade ago now, after the Rana Plaza disaster in Bangladesh, there was a big effort and partly successful too.
And we should just say, let me just stop because not everybody remembers, but
yeah.
That's of course the catastrophic fire
yeah.
that killed hundreds of garment workers.
It was a collapse of a building. Yeah, it was just a collapse of a poorly constructed huge building.
Mm.
Yeah, it killed over 1,000 workers were just killed, and many others injured. And in the wake of that. There were efforts by NGOs and non-governmental organizations to pressure the big brands like H&M and Zara and places, and then also with the International Labor Organization to create in Bangladesh and other countries committees which would, you know, inspect these buildings and would have the right to really close them down, and it's had some impact. I mean, that was an international effort, and the incentive on to the Bangladesh manufacturers was, you want to sell your stuff in the U.S. and Europe, well, you have to adhere to certain standards. That's one effort, but I have to say that I'd be just as happy to start doing things nation by nation, and the U.S. would be a huge. I mean, take Amazon. If you had a commission of some sort that was, you know, mandated by the government, in which you would have hearings and you'd have voices of the workers and of managers, and they'd move around the country and they'd say what are the conditions like in this warehouse versus that warehouse, and then at the end of the day the commission would vote and say, well, Amazon has to change its algorithm. It has to give longer breaks. You know, it has to, until turnover is reduced from 100% a year to, you know, 30%, it's on probation. I mean, you would do a lot. I mean, you could do, that would be quite, now it isn't worker power directly, but I think it would provide the basis for workers to feel more secure, and then they might well come together. And of course, also, I think such commissions, if they existed, would be able to ban some of these intimidation tactics of the employer, which are so rife today. Yeah, that would be a terrific advance.
Now, in terms of governmental action, creating more of a social democracy, which certainly the unions should be involved
yeah.
in, but other groups in the society for reformers. We've had some things in the past, like OSHA, Occupational Safety, the Health Administration. We had minimum wage and so on and so forth. But what else can or should the government be doing, and to what extent are unions and other change-oriented groups from the left doing to support that?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to do things that will stop the intimidation, the daily intimate authoritarian intimidation that takes place in every workplace. We have civil rights laws, which have become somewhat effective. That is, you know, if someone is if there's an issue of racial or gender discrimination at work, there are some moderately effective laws. Even more important, there's a sense of shame and well, or just bad public relations that the employer feels if that accusation is made and then proven. What we have to do is get to the situation where not only are there stronger protections for workers, involved in concerted activity and speaking out, but also restore that sense of shame, sense of this is bad for the company when the accusation is made, and then the proof is shown that workers, as workers, are intimidated. And I think that the whole Bessemer, as I said, the Bessemer moment, they lost, decisively, no doubt about that. But I think it made that sense.
And, of course, we're talking about Bessemer, Alabama, where warehouse workers were seeking to unionize.
Yeah, and Bezos came out with a statement a week after his victory there, which basically was not much of a victory statement at all. It was saying we have to do a better job with our workers. That was pretty tepid stuff, but nevertheless, the beginnings of a sense of shame. I mean, having studied Walmart, I can assure you that 20 years ago, Walmart felt no sense of shame whatsoever when they squashed union organizing efforts in their various stores.
As we have the advent of the alt-right and really terrifying pushback against social democracy, issues like reform of the labor laws and so on, which sounds so promising, are still confronted with recalcitrant, at best, a Senate that is virulently anti-working class. So how do you see beginning to also build the organization of the working class to be able to break through that kind of logjam, which has stymied us and given certainly the forces of capital and frankly, the neoliberal administration are hardly befriending in terms of labor law reform. What do you think we can begin to do to organize and rebuild a culture of militancy, or, as Ken always says, put the movement back in the labor movement?
Right. That's absolutely important. And you're right to emphasize the culture, a certain culture of class solidarity. There's a realization that the working class in America is multiracial and multicultural, and obviously women are, I think, 40, half, and in many, many crucial occupations, more than half. That's important to get that realization, because it's so difficult if we carry around in our head the view that the working class is really white men in heavy industry, then, we're dead, because they hardly exist anymore. And Trump was trying to, reify that. So I think that's why I'm saying Black Lives Matter. We have to think of that as part of the working class upsurge. And the demands of a militant unified working class are, of course, more than just questions of work. They're about the whole society. That was what was true in all eras of working class upsurge in the past. So, if some of that spirit and outrage and moral righteousness that was linked to, first Occupy Wall Street, and now it was mainly white, but still, and then Black Lives Matter, and not to mention the teacher strikes of 2 years ago, there is the potential there. But I don't have a mechanism or the magic formula to evoke that, with the turning on of a switch. But the ingredients are there. I'm not giddy about Joe Biden, the way some people are, but nevertheless, the assertion that the government can do things is important. I mean, that's a break with neoliberal or Reaganite, views that the problem is the government, not and everything should left to the private. So, there are the ingredients for the working class unity and upsurge that you're speaking. They're there. They do exist.
And Nelson, is there anything that we've left out that you think is vitally important for us to focus on?
I do think it's that the Biden program, especially the next couple, the one on families and health care work, making care work part of infrastructure, that it's good in terms of the money. There's real money there, but maybe ideologically, it's equally important, because it's making the point that real work And the validity of real work, you know, extends, again, beyond the factory, beyond the construction site, into the realm of care and service and education. And that's where, you know, women and people of color are concentrated, and that's very important. It's essential when we say the word, I guess my final word, when we say the word working class, let's get rid of that ghost white in front of it and make it clear that we're talking about a multiracial working class. I think, and that, not just for people like me and you, but I mean for the entire, you know, kind of everyone who, and extending over into the center and the right. If that can be done, I think we'll have made a big, big progress.
I must ask you to punctuate that, to ask you about your thoughts about, since you've raised the issue of gender, you've raised the issue of Black Lives Matter, of racial justice, as a strategic and inherent part of the campaign, and not solely economist demands, but yeah, really looking holistically at the people. And I'm wondering to what extent you think that there is an imperative to really move to labor community coalescing, yeah, to be able to win strikes, to be able to win ultimately, and I do think, yeah, they are ultimately going to win the Amazon warehouse workers in Bessemer. They filed unfair labor practices, but to what extent do you think that has to be part of our understanding and strategies and these kind of coalitions, including, yeah, the immigrant workers centers, right, that have sprung up around, right, the country, which are enormously exciting and aggressive, right, and taking on industries that very often organized labor does not.
Well, I obviously agree with you, but let me make it a kind of a structural answer that why what you say about the worker community coalitions are actually more on the agenda, almost independent of the good ideas about it. If you have an economy where service work of all sorts, whether it's retail, UPS, hospitals, of course teachers, where the nature of that work, by its nature, is connected to the community, to you know, school kids coming to school, you know, people, customers going into shops, the UPS, which, you know, had a lot of drivers, you know, have the interface with the public, etc. So therefore, when action takes place in this service economy, which is now so much bigger than the old manufacturing economy, it can only really succeed if we have community support, and we've seen that very much. And when teachers go on strike, and teachers, by the way, are the biggest union in America today. That's also obviously true of hospital workers. Those connections between the community and the working class, especially if they're service workers, is just imperative. And the alternative, if you don't have that connection, well, then you have get a backlash. But it's more than just a kind of, you know, good idea. It's structurally part of the nature of the working class today that you have these community connections.
Yeah. The significance of organizing amongst the multiracial working class, continuing to work within and build and strengthen the unions and come up with progressive labor laws to facilitate organizing. So how important is labor still?
Yeah.
Still, in the fight for the realization of the promise of democracy, yeah, in this country.
I made the distinction between social democracy on the one side and the welfare state on the other. Now they go together, but social democracy implies not revolutionary power, but power exercised by a labor movement and popular forces of that sort, real power. The welfare state, redistribution to some degree, and providing money. And you can have neoliberal kind of technocrats like Robert Rubin who support elements of the welfare state, but are not social democrats in any way. And of course, trade unions historically, and I think still today, That is the organization of workers, into their own organizations, is still the linchpin of social democracy and of democracy within the working class. I mean, we have other organizations that are, composed of workers, the African American Church, which played a heroic role in the last 200 years, really. We have, community groups, et cetera. But there's something about the organization of the working class around its work, which I think is both powerful, it's permanent, and it has to fight every day. I often make the point that we have elections, and lots of liberal groups, are very active in the day, leading up to the election. But once the election's held, then they often dissipate. But trade unions, they have to be there the day after the election. They have to be fighting on whether it's in the state capitol or Washington or on the shop floor the day after the election and the weeks and months and years afterwards. So that's one thing that is essential about trade unions are still vital, and the fact that they're only 10% of the entire working population is a huge danger today.
Nelson Lichtenstein, thank you so much for spending time with us, for your enthusiasm, your energy, the fact that you apply your theory and analysis to activism to advance the needs of the multiracial working class to take its proper role for the realization, the true promise of democracy to be realized in its interests. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong, stay well, and educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.